history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there right around you that really ought to be told. We don't want to miss out on incredible stories that change our perspective, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do so, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. You are in for a treat today with a centenarian. He just turned 100 years old. He also just got back from Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor survivor Mickey Ganich of San Leandro, California, is our guest today. But we're sitting here in the City of Oakland Senior Center inside a pretty historic building. This is the Veterans Memorial Building here in
the
Oakland?
The Memorial Building, but this is the only active, really, veterans organization that meets here regularly. We have American Legion meets down the hall, but they're just here part of the week, and we're the only one. So few of us are here that they renamed it Senior Centers so that all seniors are available here. They have dances, they have all kinds of classes, everything here. And so about 4 or 5 years ago, they started calling it Senior Center, but that's all right.
And you're here how many days a week?
Only 5 days a week here.
Only 5 days a week, yeah. For a full work day, basically. Yeah. How do you get here?
I drive. In fact, I just renewed my driver's license for five years.
Till you're 105.
Yeah, about that. And then I'll renew it then. And then when I get to 110, I'll just wonder, maybe I'll renew it and maybe I won't. Depends on how I feel at that time.
Well, and I just bring that up because I want people to understand that we're talking to someone who's 100 years old, but is still here 5 days a week volunteering. He also volunteers at the VA clinic, has spent more than 9,000 hours doing that. And he's the head usher at his Methodist church. How long are you going to do that at the church?
Another 10 years or so.
Someone told you it's a lifetime appointment?
Lifetime, because the guy before me died there, so maybe it's a lifetime. When I expire around, when I'm about 110, 115 there, then I'll actually be quit being the usher then.
Fair enough, yeah. Fair enough. Well, I know a lot of people will be interested in hearing what your secret is for being so active at 100 years old, but don't tell us just yet. Let's build the suspense on that. I want to take you back in time, because there are a lot of parts of your story that are really incredible for those of us to understand here today. We're going to talk plenty about December 7th, 1941, but I want to understand your life before that, because you're one of 14 kids?
14 kids. I'm number 12 out of 14 kids. I'm a farm boy from Ohio there. Lived on the farm all my life. Well, not all my life, the first 19 years of my life. And then I joined the Navy, and so I haven't lived there permanently since then.
So what was that life like growing up in Ohio, and what was the name of your hometown?
Mogadore, Mogadore. That's a little town, suburb of Akron, Ohio, northern Ohio. But this is a small town. I think its population was 2,100. I think that counts the cats and dogs, too. So it wasn't too big of a town. But
well, I'm sure there are plenty of animals on your farm, too, that could have counted.
Milking cows and feeding the hogs and chicken and ducks there, and we always had animals there. It's just a dairy farm, only 105 acres.
Only 105 acres.
Yeah.
That's why they needed so many kids. Yeah. And your folks were immigrants from Yugoslavia?
Yes. My father is Serbian, my mother's Russian. They both came from Belgrade area, which is the capital of Yugoslavia. Of course, it's split up now, but at that time era, they only had one place, and that was the whole town. Now it's split up in various parts, but the immigrants came to this country.
And did they tell you much about that, about life in the old country, or why it was important for them to come to America?
Yeah, well, funny part of it is there, my father was really a draft dodger. They wanted to put him into the army there in Yugoslavia there, and that's against his will, and so he came to California in about 1890 and settled here, and he was a tailor, used to make clothes, and he found out from his relatives that he had here that they knew a seamstress back in Yugoslavia was really good at it, and they corresponded back and forth. They liked what they saw, and my father sent money to her and her father to come to this country. Never seen each other till then. Got married, and as a result, 14 kids, so it must have worked out all right.
Otherwise, you wouldn't be here.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, and there are a lot of people who wouldn't be here if you didn't make it through World War II, which we're going to talk about. But I'm just curious, because it sounds so much different from the life we know now. Yeah. So when you're one of 14 kids on a 105-acre farm in Ohio, what is that childhood like? A lot of chores?
Lots of chores there. The first thing, as soon as I got big enough to milk the cows, that's the main job for me, milking the cows. That's the old-fashioned way of milking there, and not with the automatic milker there. You do old-fashioned way, you did it by hand.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you could still do that if they needed you to.
Oh, yeah. All kinds of chores there. There's a fruit and vegetable mainly, so had all kinds of work to do at that time. Evidently, my dad wanted a lot of laborers there, and so as soon as we got of age there, we flew the coop there, because working 7 days a week here on a farm from before daylight to after dark there got kind of old there, so we flew the coop as soon as we got of age.
Well, and that was what I was curious about, you know, when you're in that kind of life, and then you go through the Great Depression as you did. Do you have some hopes and dreams, some ideas? Hey, when I get off of this farm someday, here's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, I wanted something there to a little bit more relaxing there, because my father believed in work, and it seemed like he invented work there for us to do. Relatives would come to our house on weekends there, and he'd always find some kind of work for us to do there. He wasn't very good at letting us play there. Work was for people to do. Got kind of old.
Is that why you got into sports? So you could have more time away from the farm?
Actually, in sports, I was always active in football. But my dad there wanted us home after school. In fact, I got paddled many, many times because I'd stay after school playing football or playing games there. And he said that isn't the place for it. And I got beat with switches there. Fly swatter is there, anything is handy there. In fact, I got hit with one time, he hit me with a 2x4.
Ooh.
In fact, I still got the black and blue marks because there was a nail in it. So I got hit with that. I put my arm up to protect me from getting hit in the head there, because I stayed after school playing instead of coming home. So we had a pretty strict father.
I guess so. What'd you do when you finished up high school?
I was always active in sports. In fact, I played 2 years of high school, and I played 1 year of semi-pro football back there in the Akron area there. But the only jobs that's available was WPA, that's Work Progress Administration, at Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Herbert Hoover determined that a way of creating jobs there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I saw no future in that, and I had a brother and sister living in Oakland, California, and they said, well, come on out there and we'll see what we can do. So I was able to get a job in a rubber company, Pacific Tire and Rubber Company in Oakland. I came to California in 1939.
80 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow. What was it like here? I'm sure it's a little different now in 2019 than it was in 1939.
Well, it was a job, and it wasn't a job where on the farm where you had to work every day of the week. You had to nights off and weekends off, which made it a lot nicer than it was back on the farm. So I enjoyed it there.
But the rubber factory job didn't last that long either?
Well, they went on strike every year about Christmas time, and so I saw no future in that. And then the world situation was getting so bad in 1939, 1940, that the United States had a draft All men were 21 years and older. I had to register for the draft there. They said, you register for the draft and you go into the service, you're going to the Army. They said, you go in the Army here, you could be sleeping outside there and cold food there. And that wasn't for me, so I joined the Navy. So call me a draft dodger, too. So I joined the Navy January 21st in 1941. The next draft for the Army was going to be in the spring of 1941. So I wasn't going to wait till then there and see whether I was drafted or not there. And so I picked the Navy, and it wasn't steady enough work, so I gave it up after 23 years.
Only 23 years, yeah. Only the entirety of World War II and the Korean War and almost to the Vietnam War.
In fact, I was still in the service and Vietnam was going on, but I never got to Vietnam. In fact, I joined the Navy there January 21st, 1941, the Navy recruiting office, the post office in Oakland, down the street there. Ended up my Navy career at the Navy recruiting office, the post office in Oakland, October 10th, 1963. Mm-hmm. So the same place I started, same place I ended up at.
And a lot of things happened in between there.
Yes.
And here you thought by joining the Navy you might miss out on some of the worst stuff of World War II. You didn't have to go to North Africa or the Pacific as an Army soldier, but I don't think you knew what was going to happen on December 7th of 41.
No. We were ready to play a game. We had a game. I was on the ship's football team and made the first team on. I wasn't very big. I was pretty big. I was 170 pounds there. That was big in those days. Now if you're not 250, you're nothing there. So I joined the ship's football team, and we had a great team. And we scheduled to play USS Arizona for a fleet football championship, 1 o'clock December 7, 1941. That was going to be the Super Bowl of the Navy. It was really important there. So we was going to do a little scrimmaging, get ready for the game, and leave the ship at 8 o'clock in the morning, December 7th. There was no place to change clothes. A little field was close by to us there. So we had all our padding on for the attack. When the attack came there, you go to your battle station. You don't have time to change clothes or anything. So up in the crow's nest, I went in my football uniform, all my padding on there, little trap door to get up there, pull myself through to get up there. That was my battle station. I was a lookout. Whether you're in port or not there, mm-hmm. You go where your battle station is.
Well, and I want people to understand how jolting of an interruption this was. How long had you been at Pearl as part of the Pennsylvania's crew before that day?
I joined the USS Pennsylvania August 15th, 1941. Mm-hmm. And so I was on the team on the ship itself for about 3 months or so before the war started.
So this is a pretty good adventure for an Ohio farm boy. I mean, you're out here in paradise. You get to play football for the Navy.
Yeah.
So that's what you did every weekend, was played somebody else in football?
Well, anybody, we beat. I think we had a 9-1 or a 10-1 record, something like that. We had a real good team, and we had a good record there to prove it.
And you played on the line?
I was a running guard. I protected the quarter. I wasn't big enough to be a receiver or heavy enough to carry the ball, so they used me for running interference and protecting the quarterback. That was my job.
With a leather helmet, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Not the fancy ones like we have nowadays.
I've had a lot of guys who played in that era tell me they think it was a safer game with leather helmets than it is now.
I think it was, because it still worked good for us.
But you played right there on Oahu, not far from the docks?
Yeah. It's the same place where the Aloha Stadium is right now.
Oh, okay.
Where they played this Pro Bowl, I think, is that they played it.
Yeah.
That's where the field was, where we were going to play against Arizona.
Well, and if you go to Aloha Stadium now, you can look out and see the Arizona Memorial.
Oh, yeah.
From the side of the stadium.
It's up on the hill.
They're actually going to be building a new one there now, too. Maybe they can bring you out for the dedication when they build a new stadium.
That would be nice.
So you'd done this before. This, you know, it's a routine Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Did you have any reason to believe there was any chance of the Japanese attacking?
Well, we'd been talking for months there whether we're getting a war or not, and we figured no one would bother us there. We got 8 battleships in port there. We're powerful. A country would be crazy to try to attack us. If there would be any problem at all, it'd be in the Philippines, so we don't have to worry about it. So what the policy was during the week there, the ships would go out to sea and maneuver around. around gunnery practice and all that, and be in port on the weekends there. The whole fleet would be in port practically. The only thing is, except for the aircraft carrier, aircraft carriers were not in port. They were taking planes. Admiral Halsey, when his aircraft carrier group were taking planes to Midway and Wake Island, so they were not in port. Fortunately, because that was the reason there that they were not in port, why there was no third attack, an attack on Pearl Harbor, because the aircraft carriers were not in port. The third attack for the aircraft carriers was the number one target, and the oil fields and repair facilities.
Which would have crippled
If that would have happened, we would have lost the war. We'd be talking Japanese now, because they would have took the war because the closest oil and closest repair facilities, 2,000 miles away, it would have been a disaster there. We were very fortunate, but bad weather had slowed the aircraft carriers up, and they were not in port. If it had been good weather, they'd been in port, we'd have been attacked. We'd have lost the war. It's that simple.
And there were so many other twists of fate like that throughout the nearly 4 years of war that followed. And there's much more to come with 100-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Mickey Ganich of San Leandro, California. Make sure you visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for photos and video of Mickey. And when we come back, more of how he experienced December 7th, 1941, aboard the battleship USS Pennsylvania. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
History in every century records a night that lives forevermore. We'll recall as into line we fall the thing that happened on Hawaii shore. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
The Sammy Kay Orchestra with Remember Pearl Harbor, a rallying cry reverberating around America in the early stages of World War II. And perhaps you saw it a couple years ago when our guest today, Mickey Ganich, burst into song with those lyrics at the White House in front of the president. Mickey is 100 years old now, and you heard him say he just renewed his driver's license for 5 more years. And 5 days a week, he drives to the Oakland Senior Center to volunteer in the Disabled American Veterans Office. The building is almost as old as Mickey is. It's the Veterans Memorial Building in downtown Oakland, built in 1926. Out front, you'll find a torpedo port from the USS Maine, whose destruction spurred the Remember the Maine rallying cry for the Spanish-American War. So if you're ever in downtown Oakland to check out any of that history, make sure you step inside and find Mickey and get some living history. He was definitely living it on December 7th, 1941. So let's talk about how the farm boy from Ohio experienced this. You just turned 22 a few weeks before that.
Yeah.
So you're in your football pads getting ready for a scrimmage before the big game with the Arizona at 1. And what was your first indication that the Japanese were there?
Well, the living compartment of the courtroom, in fact, to be a quartermaster. Let me tell you how I became a quartermaster. They asked me what I'd like to do. I got good grades. I took my education seriously. I got good grades in my tests, and they said, what would you like to do? I said, well, I'm not mechanically minded. I'd like to do something there that would not require mechanical aptitude there. They said, how you like to steer a ship? I said, that's great for me. Because back there in Ohio, the biggest thing we saw at Lake Erie was ferry boats there. And I said, oh, they said, yeah, how'd you like to steer a ship inside of the harbor, outside the harbor, out at sea? I said, that's for me. So they made me a quartermaster. So I went to quartermaster and signal school in San Diego. And then when I got on the ship there, one of the main duties there was steering the ship. And I ended up steering that 33,000-ton battleship in and out of the harbors there, all over the Pacific, it seemed like there. That's pretty good for a farm boy. And I never even saw anything bigger than a ferry boat up close. Mm-hmm. And then steer that 608 feet long, 33,000-ton battleship. I thought that was pretty good for a farm boy.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't steer it on December 7th, though, because it was in dry dock.
That's right. We had propeller tow. Fortunately, normally when we were in port, we would tie up at a dock, 10-10 mm-hmm. dock. That's how long that dock is, 1010 feet long. We always had an admiral aboard when we went out at sea because we were the flagship of the fleet. Mm-hmm. Whenever we came in port, we tied up at the dock there. But a couple of days before that, we had propeller tow. They put us in dry dock with two other destroyers, casting in the Downs, saying we weren't in our normal place there. The ships have moved into the place where we normally did be. I torpedoed Ogallala on the hull and I got hit. They were the place where we would be because I found out later two Japanese airplanes were scheduled to hit the USS Pennsylvania. They wanted to make sure they knock out the flagship ship of the fleet because, you know, in your Indian movies, you knock out the chief, you got a better chance to win the war. Mm-hmm. They wanted to make sure that the Pennsylvania was hit. Well, the Ogallala was sunk, the Helena was damaged there, but they were aiming for us, but we weren't in our normal place, fortunately.
So for you, you started to tell me where the living quarters were and what your first alarm to this situation was.
We're going to leave the ship at 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. It takes about 4 or 5 minutes to get from the living compartment, the quartermaster's, to get up on deck, so we leave the ship at 8 o'clock. About 6 minutes to 8, the phone rang. I picked up the phone. One of the fellows on the deck was up on deck of our gang. Called on and said, Japanese attack in Pearl Harbor. I said, oh, come on, let's not talk about it. Because we'd been talking about it for months there, but we feared there's no chance for us. About that time, the ship shuddered. Some of our fellows that were close to the guns went to the guns and started shooting at the planes before we knew below decks knew what was going on. About that time, General Quarters went, all hands man your battle stations. Now, get from there up to the poles there, which you, I guess you'd call it there, the mast there with the closeness, that's where I had to go. So by the time I got up there, ships were burning, planes were burning, planes were flying around there. Look close enough, you hit them with rocks. If you had anything to throw at them, I could have thrown my binoculars at them because I was a lookout. That was all I had up there. But by the time I got up there, just a few minutes time, because you're going double time or triple time, get up there in a hurry because you don't know what was going on. It was pretty hectic.
Yeah.
But I was well protected with all my padding on.
All your football pads.
Oh, yeah. A little trap door to get through there. Pull myself through with all the padding on. I couldn't go straight through. It wasn't that wide. So I pulled myself through with my trap door and get up there. And it was kind of bad looking, seeing planes coming all around you. And it got pretty rough. But the Japanese didn't know where we were the first attack that they had, because we weren't in our normal place. But evidently, some of the Japanese pilots reported to the aircraft carrier that there's a big ship in dry dock with two other destroyers. So the second attack, they hit us. Bomb missed me by 45 feet. armor-piercing bomb, 500-pound bomb, came on past me. I'm on the course, and I said, came way down, exploded way below me. If it exploded on contact, I wouldn't be here talking to you. It's kind of scary to see a big hole alongside of you there.
So if it had been a conventional bomb as opposed to armor-piercing, it would have gone off on the deck, and you would have been gonzo.
Yeah.
And as it stands, you're up on this crow's nest. So when that bomb detonates below deck, I'm sure that was quite an earthquake for you.
It really shook me, but we didn't know where it hit because if I saw the bomb coming, I probably died right there. But it came on past me, and I saw the result of it, but I didn't see it happening.
And this whole time, because of your elevated position, you're seeing a whole lot of other things.
Yeah. In fact, my job was to look how to report anything of interest there I could report, or what it is of phones on the ship itself. It's sound-powered phones is what it is. I would see the plane coming over the top of the buildings, because the building's fairly close to us, too. I saw this plane coming over the top of the buildings. I reported to it there. They turned the guns around, facing that direction. When he came past his building, pow, we got him. That's the only plane we knocked down there. If they had trained the guns around to get the plane, they never had it, but they had the guns trained in that direction. So when the plane come over that way, they got him. They were ready for him.
And
so
you gave him a good scouting report.
Yeah. That made me feel pretty good. I did accomplish something.
Well, and if you hadn't, that plane might have done something to your ship, too.
That's right.
You know, you hear a lot about D-Day as the longest day, but I'm wondering how long December 7th, 1941 felt for you.
It felt pretty long there, but we're just glad because in between there was about 10-15 minute gap in between the first attack and second attack. So I had a chance to look around and get below and change clothes, get out of my football uniform on and get in my regular clothes. And then you didn't really have time to think about it. But I saw the results there. I saw the hole alongside me where the bomb came. Saw machine gun nicks in the ladder where I climbed up to get up to the crow's nest. Whether it happened before I went up there, after I went up there, or during the time I went up, I don't know, but they didn't get me. That's kind of scary, too.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't see what could have happened there, but I figured God had other plans for me. He's looking out for me.
Well, apparently he still is here at age 100. So if you looked from the crow's nest on the Pennsylvania around the harbor, what else did you see in those moments?
I see all these ships burning, all the people shooting boats out in the water, picking up people that were blown off the ship there, all harboring, and see everything up high enough, gone about 70, 80 feet up in the air above the ground there. And that was enough to see over the top of these buildings that they had. So I had a bird's eye view of what was going on. So I could see what was happening there. And saw the USS Nevada, the battleship, try to get outside the harbor, which is the foolish and craziest thing to do. If it had been sunk in a channel, nobody would have been able to get in and out. So they finally wised up and grounded it, run to the ground. Well, we feared it couldn't happen to us. Like I said, we'd been talking about maybe getting a war with Japan there for a long time. In fact, some of our people were even helping. Some of our people, like, joined the Flying Tigers there with General Chenalta. But since we were not in the war, they were on their own. In fact, some of our pilots went over to join the RAF, the Royal Air Force, flew with them, even though the country itself was not in the war, because we had sympathizers there, but we were not in a war itself, technically.
Which changed on that morning for you. And I know it's a long time ago, but I'm sure you still remember what that felt like. How frightening or alarming or just jolting was that?
Well, it really, you don't have, when that's happening, you don't have time to think about it. You're trained to do job. My job was to do this and do that, same with the other people on the ship. But really, you don't think about it. All you can think about what could have been, and then think about the future, what you can do to get ready for the future. All you can do is prepare and do what you can there. Some people's job is to repair the ship. Some people work on the engine. My job at that particular time was a lookout because that was the lowest position of my gang. At that time, I was the newest one in that gang. And so just think about what could have happened, but you don't think about it. You don't have time to think about it.
And I know you just returned from Pearl Harbor for the 78th anniversary, and I'm sure every time you go back, you see things and understand things maybe you didn't before. But one of the most striking photographs from December 7th is of the destroyer USS Shaw exploding.
Pieces of it there, when it exploded, fell on us. We were that close to it.
So you saw that happen in real time?
Well, I saw the result. I didn't see what, I didn't happen to be looking in that particular direction because I'm looking around, see what else I can report there. So I didn't see it, but we saw pieces of it there that we recognized as pieces of the USS Shaw. That was quite an explosion.
When that second wave of the attack was done, was there concern that we don't know if it's over? What happens next?
Well, we figure there's going to be an invasion. Mm-hmm. Getting ready. And in fact, that night, all people were instructed to go to the Army draw, get rifles and ammunition and canteens and stuff to get ready to go ashore to help the Army repel the invasion because they figured it could be invaded.
How'd you feel about that?
Well, in the Navy, when we're trained, we're not trained so much with rifles, all like the Marines in the Army there. So a lot of us there would be a detriment there because we wouldn't be that capable of handling rifles and stuff like the Marines in the Army would there. So some of them were a little bit leery and some of them never even had a gun in her hands or up close, and so everybody's a little bit leery about what we do, what we can do with this there. But we were ready because we didn't know what to expect.
Well, sure. So that makes me curious about what the days and weeks that followed were like. What kinds of things were you doing? What were you hearing?
Well, just trying to fix it up the ship there and wondering whether there was going to be anything more. Waiting for news of what was happening there, and we did find out there that blocks along there, see, we were attacked there, so the next morning, Franklin Delano Roosevelt got Congress to declare war on Japan.
In one of the most famous and most frequently listened to speeches in history, which we're going to get a taste of when we come back. One thing I'm starting to realize, I think Mickey Ganich's story is one we're probably going to have to stretch over two episodes of Hometown Heroes, because I really don't want to leave anything out. When we come back, more of his perspective on December 7th, 1941, and what followed, and how Mickey learned of his connection to one of the men still entombed on the USS Arizona. Remember to visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and video of this spirited centenarian. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHSmaster will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
You've likely heard those words a time or two. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressing Congress on December 8, 1941. But how often have you heard the rest of that speech? 100-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Mickey Gannich of San Leandro, California, could tell you quite a bit about it. We're going to jump back into his story in a moment, but right now let's hear some excerpts of how the president made the case for Congress declaring war in the wake of those December 7th attacks 78 years ago.
United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation and, at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understand the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense, but always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God.
FDR on December 8th, 1941, a date that found 22-year-old Mickey Gannich still at Pearl Harbor. That football game with the Arizona would never happen. 2,400 of his fellow Americans had been killed. And between machine gun bullets and that bomb that hit the Pennsylvania, he had come pretty close himself. And now he was watching America respond to what happened and to the tone the president's speech had set.
We had blocks long, people lining up there. The men were going in the service. We were attacked there. The country is united. Everybody wanted to do their part there. So up to that time, the men were the wage earners and the women were staying at home taking care of the family and the kids. Now the men are gone. So what happened? The women stepped in. They started building planes, tanks, guns, ships. They did everything. You've seen the sign, "We can do it" there.
Rosie the Riveter.
Rosie the Riveter, they did do it. In fact, I had two sisters that were Rosie Riveters. One worked at Treasure Island, and one worked at the Oakland Naval Supply Depot. They're doing their part. The men were gone. That's how the women got into the service. So between the No Third attack at Pearl Harbor and the women stepping in and doing, furnished us with what we needed, we won the war.
It would be a long effort, and you'd be a part of a lot of it in the Pacific. What about the aftermath there at Pearl? Did you have to participate in any cleanup or processing?
No, they had enough of those people. All we doing getting that. In fact, it's less than 2 weeks. We're on our way back to San Francisco, getting new guns, getting ready for fighting a war, getting ready for the worst that was going to happen.
How much did it weigh on you that 2,400 Americans had lost their lives and all these ships and planes and so many things were destroyed?
Well, a lot of us are just thinking about get revenge, get back, get do for someone to do that to us, or that we want to get even. That didn't do our part, do what we can to get back at them and get back there. You can't give back the lives of the people that died there, but we could try to protect the others that are still with us.
And there were men from your ship who were killed that day?
We had lost 23 men injured. I'm not sure how many of them. You know, all those, some of them that were injured, a lot of them died there. But that particular day and that particular 2 hours, less than 2 hours, we lost 23 men plus the injured.
And, of course, the Arizona lost 1,177 and the Oklahoma lost 429.
Yeah.
And you would find out later that one of those men aboard the Arizona was an old high school rival of yours?
Yes. I played football against him there. He went to different school, and he's one of them and still listed. He's on the list of the people who died on the Arizona. He's one of them. But I didn't find that out till I went back to Ohio to visit the next year. That's when I found out he's still on. Now, I'm sure I would have played football against him because I played football against him during our school days.
And what was his name?
It was Howard Royer, R-O-Y-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
He lived about 150 yards down the street from me back in a farm in Ohio.
So you had played against him in high school, and you probably would have been playing against him the afternoon of December 7th.
Yes. Of course, we would have won the game anyhow. There's no doubt about it. We would have won. We had the best team. Because I may be prejudiced a little bit.
Maybe a little bit. And how many times do you think you've been back to Pearl Harbor in all these years since?
Well, I was in and out. Well, in the time in the service, so I was many times. Because I was on the battleship Pennsylvania, the same ship I was on at whole World War II. Well, they used us for fire support, the various invasions. So the only thing we did in the Pacific, my ship was the invasion of Attu, Kiska, Macon, Kwajalein, and Uituak, Palau, Saipan, Guam, and Philippines. That's the only ones that invasion my ship was in. On
the only ones, yeah. You were in more than you weren't in.
Yeah, well, we were not shooting enemy ships. We were shooting enemy troops in support of our troops that were on land.
Well, and I want to hear some of those stories, as many as you're willing to tell. But I'm just curious, with all the times you've gone back to Pearl, and when you go to the USS Arizona Memorial, and you see all those names where your old rival Royer is up there.
Yeah.
What do you think about? What goes through your mind when you examine that loss of life and know how close you were to it?
Well, close. See, when they assigned me to the ship, they could have assigned me to the Arizona. So I think it's my fortune there. Luck was with me, or God was with me there, that I could be there instead. They're over here. And so I figured there that God had other plans for me. That's why I think he had other plans for me there, to teach the kids, give them a little history lesson there, tell them a story of what really, really happened there. And I'm doing it for them, really, because they can't do it. They're not here to do it. But I can. I'll do it while I can, and I plan on doing it for years to come, too.
And I know you've been doing it for a long, long time. Is there a part, an element of the Pearl Harbor story that you don't think gets told enough, or that people aren't aware of as they should be?
Well, I learned a lot there, that you've got friends. Friends that look out for you, and actually you're looking out for each other. You're looking out for them. They're looking out for you. It's a teamwork. Before, it was just on the football field for that particular day. But here we're fighting a war, fighting for our country, fighting for our lives there. So it's meaningful there that you're looking out for each other. That's what I learned. In fact, when I was growing up, I got in trouble many times there. But I learned by it. I make a mistake here because my dad would beat me for doing something wrong, and sometimes he'd beat me for my brother's doing something wrong there because he figured I'd be the culprit. But so I learned by experience here, learned by mistakes here. Do under others like you'd have others do under you, because it's not a one-man war. It's a group of people, a group of services fighting, all working together.
Yeah, 16 million Americans in uniform during World War II. And you mentioned the contributions your sisters made. Out of all 14 of those kids, how many of you were involved in the war effort?
Just my brother, the one that's a year and a half older than me.
What did he do?
He was in the Marines. He spent 21 years in the Marines, and I spent almost 23 years in the Navy. But we were the only ones. But that's really something there, since my father was a draft dodger. He could call me a draft dodger, too, because I didn't want to go in the Army. I joined the Navy.
Were you and your brother ever in the same place in the Pacific?
Yes.
Did you get to see each other?
Yeah, a couple of times. In fact, I didn't see him until the Korean War. Mm. We met there. I was on an ammunition ship during the Korean War, and he was in the aviation with the Marines there, and he was at one of the air bases in Wonsan in Korea, and we got together there for one short time there. But then after I came back to the States there, I got to see him, but only one time we met overseas.
You know, and since we're talking about family, another point on Pearl Harbor that I'm interested in. You know, today if something happens and a serviceman's family is concerned, did something happen to my loved one? I mean, there's phones, there's the internet, there's instant communication. In 1941, I'm sure there was at least some period of uncertainty for your family when they heard that Pearl Harbor had been attacked.
Oh, yeah. They were worried about it there, and communications were pretty hard because telephones would all be jammed up, and so you couldn't call. When we finally was able to call, let them know we're all right, it made a difference there, made a relief to them.
Here's another goofy question for you. Since you were supposed to play a football game on December 7th, and I know you were with the Pennsylvania's crew the rest of the war, was there ever another chance to play a game throughout the war?
Well, we played sports there. In fact, I was a good bowler, and it wasn't until after the war that I organized bowling leagues for my ship there. And I was active in sports there. But during the war, unless you were in port, and it'd be important in back in the United States, because we were back and forth at different times there. We could go to games, and things were quite limited.
So in other words, he never did get to play another football game for the Battleship Pennsylvania team. Since Mickey is already planning to renew his driver's license again in 5 years at age 105, I'm hoping they're going to invite him to the opening of the new Aloha Stadium in 2023. Maybe he can perform a ceremonial first snap. I know he can do it because at the 78th Pearl Harbor anniversary commemoration earlier this month, he got down in a three-point stance opposite former Pro Bowl linebacker Donnie Edwards. You can find a photo of that online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And you'll also find video of this moment at the White House 2 years ago.
Throughout the war, one great battle cry could be heard by American friends and foes alike. Remember Pearl Harbor. Have you heard that before a couple of times? Remember Pearl Harbor.
Remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet a foe. Just remember Pearl Harbor as we dig the Alamo. We shall always remember how they died for liberty. Just remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
Yes. What can I say? Wow, that was good. He's a very shy person, too. And a great football player.
So there's one reason not to miss our next episode. We'll get the rest of Mickey Gannich's Navy story and his perspective on that memorable moment with the president. We're out of time on this episode, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, wishing you the merriest of Christmases, encouraging you to say an extra prayer for our men and women in uniform this holiday season, and reminding you once again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses going to your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.